We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Einstein at GoGo.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Einstein A Go-Go. I'm Dr. Shane. Thank you so much for tuning in for an hour of science here on 3RRR. There's going to be a big show. We have three guests eagerly awaiting their time in the studio out in the green room. And in the studio with me is Chris KP. Good morning.
Hello.
You're very enthusiastic.
Well, yes. That's true. I feel like I've been here for ages.
I know. It's
Hence
been like
enthusiasm,
a month.
You know.
Or more. Yeah,
well, yeah, something like that.
It happens. Yeah. And Dr. Susie, good morning.
Good morning. Well, I was here last week, but I wasn't allowed to come.
I know. There was a scheduling issue.
You were banned?
I was the back pocket joker card, and then I got put back in the back pocket.
I don't know who the producer of this show is, but we should be hung.
It's all right. Oh. I'm here now. You missed me. I know it. It's fine.
Wow. So you came in. What did you do? You just hung out.
I just was here, had a chat to Shane. Everyone else showed up, and I'm like, I'm out of here. And then I watched football, which is what I've done all week. And
I feel like Dr. Shane has missed an opportunity for like a bidding war or something. You know, who wants to be on the program and how badly?
And Dr. Susie was very polite. When she says had a chat to Shane, she says Shane realizes his mistake. And she very, very politely left.
It's like, I was never here.
Because I was like, how can I fit this extra person in the studio?
This is where my smoke bombs come in. You know?
I'm sure I'll pay for this at some stage in the future. But
oh, yes,
yeah.
Anyway, before we start our new segment, I just wanted to say that it is the end of the financial year, everyone, and that means it's an important time for RRR. In fact, every donation made to RRR this June will be matched up to a total of $50,000 thanks to our generous supporters. Up. That's the name of the spot. Sorry. I probably read that badly. But all donations above $2 are tax deductible, which means the greedy little treasurer cannot get their hands on some of it. And so, you know, doubling your donation at RRR. So if you want to do that, you want to help out RRR, go to RRR.org.au/donate. And anything you donate will be doubled, and your donation above $2 will be tax deductible. So it would be great if you could do that. We would very much appreciate any support.
Thank you.
Something, I don't know what this financial year thing is we're talking about. I haven't come across that before, but sounds important.
Yeah, it does sound important, doesn't it?
Sounds like something I should know about.
Something significant.
Yes,
for some reason it's now and not in December,
yeah,
it's fine.
Indeed. Weird, huh?
The Europeans are confused.
Yeah, or the Americans like in March or something. Yeah. I'm like, what the hell, man?
We're just
getting
by
started.
Good
sense. It's like it's the angle of the sun or something like that. I can't work it out. Now, speaking of things important, you've been digging stuff up news-wise around fungi.
I know. I was so stressed out this morning that I needed some like calming science news. So I came across this. Yes, I watched the football. Don't talk about it.
Oh, that's right.
We won, it's fine. Anyway, right to bring it up. No, I found a story about fungi, and I find this interesting because fungi in forests have this like symbiotic relationship with trees. You know, they give them nutrients in the soil, mainly getting it out of the CO2 in the air, so they're incredibly important for us. But also, they are just incredibly vast, but invisible to us. And there's always this, like, you know, what are we going to see of them? How can we measure where there is? And there's tons of stories, and we talked about this before the show, where, you know, you test one fungi, you know, whatever, company, colony, whatever, in one area.
Club.
It's an exclusive
club. Yeah.
And you go a few kilometers further and you test the same one with different methods. And it's still the same species, like still the same organism. And you're like, this is incredible. How far can this go? And this research study actually looked into this, and they looked at one specific one, which is, and pardon my butchering of this name, arbuscular mycorrhizal fungal network. So they're called AM fungi.
Perfect pronunciation.
Totally. Yeah. AM fungi is the short version of that. And they checked it in 16,000 soil core samples.
Okay.
Which is, you know, if you're coming from Europe and you fly there every kilometer would be a sample taken, which is incredible across the globe. It's a bit of work. So they live in the topsoil of mainly grasslands and things that are like underwater, like the, you know, Everglades in Florida and stuff. And they checked 16,000 cores, and they found, well, put the data in a machine learning network, established it across the globe, and they found that it spans estimated 110 quadrillion kilometers off the globe. Yep.
What percentage? Like, familiar with quadrillion myself
and the globe.
How much of the globe is that?
These numbers are insane. And I was asking the same question. Yeah. I was like, what does this number mean? I can't picture this. Yeah, yeah. So you know, if you're thinking numbers, so 1 million is a number that in Melbourne everyone can deal with because of house prices, right? So it has 6 zeros. 1 6 zeros.
Right. Okay.
Then after that we have a billion, which is 9 zeros. Right. Trillion, 12 zeros. Yeah. Quadrillion, 15 zeros.
Whoa.
So 110. And then 15 zeros is the number of kilometers, which is about roughly a billion times the distance between the Earth and the Sun.
So what you're saying is, if you measured every bit of this planet in length,
and you put it out like one,
and you lay
string,
it in one big thing,
it's 4 billion times. From the Earth to the Sun and back.
That's a lot of...
You'd get bored going to the Sun, wouldn't you, many times?
That's a lot of fungus.
Yeah.
It is.
And they actually did the work on this and visualized this. So for everyone who's not driving right now, I highly recommend going on your interwebs and Googling this, the AM, you know, fungi network. And they build like a little global map, you know, which looks like when the light's on certain places.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating where... It's, you know, accumulating in bigger areas, and we're not in where it's dark because under the ocean it's not. But it's incredible. It's a really beautiful picture, you know, if you're into pictures of the Earth. The more important thing, though, is, as I said, they're pulling CO2 out of the air, right?
Yeah.
And speaking of numbers, these fungi networks are so good at this that they are taking out of the air 11% of the... I'll read it out from the news article. Human-related carbon dioxide emissions overall, so all of the carbon dioxide emissions that we've ever done, 11% of this per year, and bringing it into the soil for plants to chop on, you know, and eat for photosynthesis to make.
And that's one of the reasons why you don't go and wreck the soil.
Exactly.
It's actually putting it in the soil, keeping it in the soil.
Yep.
That's a good place to keep it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, when we think about what harms this, the main impact is agricultural croplands. So the more crop we plant, the more we rip it up, and the more we destroy the nutrient structure of the soil. So not only is it chopped up in pieces, but also it can't actually grow there anymore because there's not enough other nutrients for it. So it is predicted that about 50% of this will be lost over the next couple of years because of environmental stress and agricultural cropland need.
That's a huge impact.
Yeah. So, you know, think about that when you
drop from 11% extraction to 5%.
Yeah.
5.5% extraction.
If it's linear, it could be worse.
Yeah, it could be worse. Yeah. Wow. Amazing stuff.
I know. The numbers are insane, right?
Insane numbers.
Insane.
Thank you, Dr. Susie.
Love it.
Chris KP.
I found a little story in invertebrate biology about hermit crabs.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're not familiar with hermit crabs, they're crabs.
Who is not familiar with hermit crabs? Sorry.
I would imagine very few people. And, in fact, it's funny you should mention that because my very, very superficial research on listenership to this station suggests there are very few hermit crabs listening. That's relevant. I'll get to that, why I checked that out in a moment. So the thing about the hermit crab is that they live inside... shells
things.
Or whatever they can get their claws
things.
On.
Yeah.
And obviously when they're alive, they're getting bigger and eventually they need to change shells or something else.
Yeah.
Which is fine, except of course there isn't like there's a constant display of shells of the right size lying around.
Choose this one.
So sometimes you're kind of stuck with the one you've got for a bit and you just got to deal with
squishy.
That for a while. Yeah, so here's the question. If you were stuck inside something that would not expand with you and you were, you know, the risk is you're going to basically get too big for it, what do you do?
Grow outside? Can you grow outside?
Not really. Good thought, though. That's good engineering, just to do your growing bits poking out. But that defeats the purpose of having a shell, too.
Hibernate the growth for a while, hey?
Slow down the growth. And here's the interesting thing. Mm. They've actually studied this. What they found is they do actually slow down the rate at which they get bigger.
Wow.
So here's the next question. How do you do that?
Good question.
Eat less, sleep more.
You would think eat less. That's the obvious place to go. So what they found is a bunch of scientists finally actually went, well, hang on, let's just do this.
Yeah.
So they got some crabs in tight shells, ultimately, and put food out for them. They all ate the same amount of food. Didn't matter how big or small their shell was, how roomy or not it was.
So more exercise?
They just chat more. That's the answer. They literally assimilate less nutrients.
Wow.
So they eat as much, but it doesn't go into... And I'm thinking, this is weight loss. This is weight loss
How
gold.
Do they do it?
Exactly. Now, the reason I mentioned how many hermit crabs listen to the program is if you are not a hermit crab, this is not the answer to weight loss.
Yeah. And do not put hermit crabs in a blender and think it will help you. That is not okay.
Actually, that's the least not okay thing I was thinking. Yeah, sure. But yeah, how cool is that? They basically just go, oh, I'm going to keep eating because I need that for lots of reasons.
Yeah,
and also,
it's
hard to slow that down and speed it up. And food comes and goes in unreliable amounts. You take it when you can get it. But if I'm going to hurt myself by outgrowing, I need to just not use as much
but
of this to get
how
bigger.
How do they signal this? Like, you know, do they have like cells on the outer layer that's
I don't know.
Oh, this is getting a bit tight. We better not take the nutrients.
I'm assuming they can sense pressure.
Yeah, right.
Or something as they move, I guess. I don't know whether it's active, whether it's just feeling it against them. I don't know. It's a good question.
Because, like, their stomach is somewhere else.
Yeah.
And how would they know that it's tight out there?
There's some sort of neural connection between
the
two.
That's crazy.
How good are they?
Love
I wonder
that.
If they just become more belligerent and say, oh, there's a shell I wouldn't mind having. Excuse me.
Knock, knock, knock. Give me your
Will you be using that?
Well, that'd be the perfect world, wouldn't it? If you were a hermit crab of a certain size, you want to get friendly with a smaller one.
Yeah.
Or a larger one, rather. So you can go, you don't need that anymore, do you? I'll take that off your hands.
They just need to be in communities. But and it's just the person at the top end that has the trouble.
But they're quite picky.
Everyone else is past the shell.
It's a reversal of our society. The person at the top is in the worst possible spot.
It is a version of musical chairs.
Nobody wants to be at the top.
It's musical shells where the person at the top, they're in trouble.
I love that, actually.
Yeah, they get to be the person almighty
top.
Seagull.
Well, the person at the top shits the most, too. That's the other thing.
That's equivalent of our world, anyway.
Problem solved.
They're quite picky, though. I saw videos of, like, you know, when you have them in a tank or whatever, and, you know, humans offering them certain shells, and they're very picky about
And let's face it, it's one of those things where, you know, the animal, like, they know what's best.
Yeah.
They've been doing this for a long time.
And then
don't
you see them in a discarded sardine tin or something.
Don't tell me what I like.
Something you're like,
I had them in an aquarium once, and I used to put extra little shells in there so they could, you know.
That's cool. Very cool.
Just why one of them feel...
But did they accept
like there wasn't a housing problem.
It's not like in the real world out here.
Supply and demand. That's all it is. It's supply and demand.
It is.
And there are more shells than there were crabs. So simple as that.
Do you have to get certain shells for them, or can you just take any?
I was just putting in like Coke bottle tops or something.
Did they breed?
Mine did not, but that might have just been the wrong music or something. I don't know.
Some Barry White for you.
There you go. Well, the problem is that Barry White gets the down frequency occurs when it goes through the water, so it gets even deeper.
Yes.
And then it just feels like an earthquake.
That's right. Oh, right.
And then
they
get scared.
I shall stop.
Anyway, just before we go to the break, I just wanted to mention, and this is fairly unprecedented, actually. You don't hear this very often, but the Australian Academy of Science over the last week has initiated the Restore Science campaign. So this is a campaign hitting governments, state and federal, in fact, across the country, quite hard because of the massive retraction in funding that's been occurring actually over decades now, to the point where many researchers are... I mean, the mood is just worse than I think I've ever seen it.
For reasons.
In 32 years of broadcasting here, I've never seen the mood so low in terms of how many researchers are having to leave the system and not being able to get their funding.
Yeah, less than 10% success rates will do that for you.
8%. 8% success rate. Or as I like to say, a 92% rejection rate, which feels a bit worse.
We'll do that to you.
Anyway, they've started a campaign called Restore Science. It's very easy to find, folks. If you want to get on board there and follow the links after you click on the Australian Academy of Science and their Restore Science program, you can sign the petition and so forth there, which is well worth doing. I think scientists are usually pretty polite when it comes to government. We have got to the point now, though, where enough is enough, and the most recent federal government was an absolute disgrace with regards to how much it took from science and pretended to give back, which it did not. And we're now at the stage where our expenditure relative to GDP is 1.67%. I remember screaming about this in 2008 when it was at 2.2. The OECD average is well above that, around 3%, and that number is just brutal. So if we want a future...
And it is the future.
Yeah,
it is 100%.
It affects everything. Productivity, everyone's lives are affected by us having capability. If you want to go and, you know, if you get ill and you want to be at the front line getting involved in clinical trials that save your life, all that stuff, we've got to have it here.
We are very good at destroying ourselves and this is the only thing that keeps us from it. So
I think enough is enough on this one. And the Academy of Science, which is a fairly, you know, restrained organization, actually. It's been doing this very often.
It takes them a lot,
It's taken them a lot to come out, and they've called it Restore Science, which is a very clear messaging that says it's stuffed.
Yeah.
So before we completely burn it to the ground, there is an opportunity for us to do something about it. But it's just not good enough. And with elections and that coming up, I think it's a good time to be pushing hard on this. So
more vocal.
No more down news from me today. We're going to have a couple of guests coming in the moment, folks. We've got some really good stuff on the show today. So stick around. Here's some important station announcements.
Section 8 are keeping warm this winter with mulled wine, heaters and free parties every night. Coming up, a celebration of the Matariki Māori New Year, an exhibition hosted by dance photographer Nam Chops, and a fundraiser curated by Satsang Radio. Learn more by following Section 8 Melbourne on socials. Section 8, proud Triple R sponsors.
Tune in to Buy It Into It, featuring local insights on the latest tech news and the ways technology intersects with everyday life. Wednesdays from 7 to 8pm on Triple R. Buy It Into It is sponsored by the .au domain. .au is a marker of trust online. Any website or email using .au has a registered and verified connection to Australia. It's how you know you're supporting local on a global internet. To find out more or register a .au domain, head to auda.org.au. Triple R sponsors.
The Coonahan Gallery in Brunswick is Merribeck City Council's public art gallery, presenting free political and contemporary exhibitions, programs and workshops. Current exhibitions feature artists Inoki, Nani Puspasari, Joshua Heed and Judy Kuo, bringing colourful installations, humour and compelling storytelling to the gallery. Exhibitions run until July 19 at the Coonahan Gallery. Open Wednesday to Sunday at 233 Sydney Road, Brunswick. Find out more at the Merribeck Council website. Triple R sponsors.
The Triple R text line. 0466 981027. Witness.
Yeah, welcome back, folks. You're listening to Einstein the Go-Go on 3RRR. In the studio with us now, we have Tia Brulo. Now, Tia is a research fellow in the Enabling Climate Change Adaptation section of the School of Geography, Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Melbourne. Tia, welcome to RRR.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you in here. Now, you work on essentially something we should all be thinking about, but how prepared we are with regards to climate change. So is this sort of... I've talked about this a little bit in the past on the show, but, you know, like we often hear people talking about climate change coming, but it's well and truly here.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. We've been experiencing impacts of climate change now in the last couple of years. There's been a lot of reports saying that some of the weather we've been experiencing is partly due to climate change, mm-hmm. and we can expect that to continue in the future. So broadly speaking, we can expect more extremes and more severe and frequent extreme events.
Yep.
And so understanding how we're going to prepare for that in the future and how we're going to adjust the way that we work and the way that we live is really, really important as we kind of think about how we're going to continue on in this changing climate.
Yeah.
Is there a limit to the kinds of adaptations you consider? Because in my brain immediately goes to physical things and financial things and political things, societal things. How do you define adaptation?
So climate change adaptation, broadly speaking, is just how we adjust to the changing climate that we can expect. But there's lots of researchers who focus on different aspects of that.
Okay.
So there's researchers who focus on the natural environment and how are we going to help the natural environment to adapt to climate change. There's researchers who focus on infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that involves engineers. And there's researchers who, like me, just kind of focus on the whole aspect because it's really important for us to understand adaptation across the board. And that is pretty closely linked to governance and how the
right.
government is going to help us to
yep.
prepare for climate change. So that's where my focus okay. is.
So, Tia, before we get onto your database that you've been building, because I think this is really fascinating, how do you know what things are coming? Yeah, like mm-hmm. like one of the questions I always get asked is, you know, what can we expect? You know, and I said, well, there's some stuff we know. And mm-hmm. then there's a bucket load of stuff that scientists scarily actually can't really predict that well because the system is just too complicated. So what sort of things can you utilize there?
Yeah, and that's where the climate science does come. It's really important, and we work very closely with climate scientists as part of our research. And I know you've had some of those guests, some of my colleagues on in the past. And so working with those climate scientists who project what we can expect in the future is really important. But funnily enough, for climate change adaptation, actually sometimes we don't need to know with complete certainty what's going to happen because it doesn't change what we need to do in the future. We know that we're going to have to adjust for floods, and we know that we're going to have to adjust for bushfires, and we know we're going to have to adjust for extreme heat. And the extent to which those things happen and when they happen, it doesn't really change the fact that we know that we're going to have them and we're going to have to adjust to them. So as the climate science keeps improving and keeps getting closer and closer to understanding what those things are, we can still start preparing and we can still start getting ready for what's going to happen.
Do you have to include things like, and maybe this is too sort of fine grained, but like, are there certain things like certain grapes where you have to say, look, look, that I'm sorry, but that's going to have to travel south. You're going to have to uproot those suckers, and you're going to have to plant them in Tasmania now because that's not going to work in New South Wales anymore. Like, is there things like that that you...
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe you've been looking into some of my research. So I've done some interviews in the last couple of years where I actually interviewed a couple of wine growers who have been doing exactly that and moving south to Tasmania. And there's many things they're doing in on the mainland Australia as well to prepare for climate change. So they're looking at different grape varieties. They're looking, I know CSIRO has done a lot of research to kind of developing new grape varieties that are going to last in the extreme heat conditions. But then for some of our favourite grape varieties that are grown in cooler conditions, then maybe they are better suited to Tasmania. Yeah. And the Tasmanian wine sector has gotten a lot bigger in recent years. Then they've been doing a lot of investment on kind of growing that sector.
Yeah. Is it the Derwent River down in Tasmania? Am I getting that right?
Yes,
so
yes.
I can imagine the labelling, Derwent River Wines, you know, formerly Margaret River. You know, like coming to you live from just outside Hobart, yes.
To what extent is adaptation to climate change in... To what extent does it inform... I'm thinking major infrastructure projects. So we look at... I mean, this is bad examples, but, you know, level crossing removal, suburban rail loops, widening of roads. And I'm coupling that in my own brain with what we know more and more about Melbourne's flooding and potential flooding. So... Is adaptation built into those infrastructure projects, or is it more a case of we've got a job to do, we're going to get it done?
The extent depends on where you're talking about and what their legislations are and what their kind of planning provisions are in the process. But I can tell you that it goes on a lot more than we realise it's happening already. There's a lot of really fantastic people working in the state governments and local governments whose entire job it is now is to think about how they're planning a road. Does it need to be a few centimetres higher to make sure that it's going to be above flood level or the increasing flood level? And so there's a lot of people who are working really hard on that, but it does depend on kind of which area you're into. Some areas are kind of more probably further ahead in thinking about climate change and other areas maybe a little bit behind, but they're getting there.
Now, Tia, tell us about the database, because this is something, you know, I had no idea that somebody, thankfully you, is sort of trying to pull together all of these various things that are happening. Because, as you say, there's a lot of things going on, but we don't really hear about them very often, and they're kind of in the background. So what are you trying to do with building a database of all this?
Yeah, so over the last three or nearly 4 years now, we've been building something called the Australian Adaptation Database. And the point behind that is to understand what climate change adaptation actually is. Like you say, these examples that we don't necessarily think about in our day-to-day lives. And so that looks at adaptation across Australia at state, at national, and at a local scale. And it looks at what sort of examples are actually happening so that when we talk about climate change adaptation, we have a better idea of what it is that we're talking about. We know where it's happening, and we also know if there's gaps that need to be filled where we haven't done enough work yet. So that's a really important piece of information. It's fed into things like the National Climate Risk Assessment and the National Adaptation Plan that were released last year so that government knows what's happening and where are the gaps that we need to work on in the future.
Right. It's a bit more of a philosophical question, I guess, but when you talk about the adaptation database and, you know, the, I guess there's a lot of ideas and initiatives in that would be good and, you know, will probably hopefully be somewhat taken across in action into cities. What is there a component that deals with how people are going to adapt this? Because I feel like there's a whole, there's a bit of a mindset issue in that as well. You know, if you talk about the whole problem about roads, you know, we need more floodproofing, we need them, or we build them wider, often to accommodate, say, something like bigger cars, which is something that is in the mindset of people. And my mindset is like, if anything, we should build more bike lanes. But, you know, the human trajectory is we have, over the last couple of years, had a tendency from very small cars to bigger and bigger cars, you know, more like the mini SUV thing. It has a massive impact on the climate, but also on the safety on roads. Is there a thing that deals with how people will adapt this, how ready they are to actually take this into their lives? Or is it more like it's a government incentive or a government action point that they do?
So what you're talking about is what we sometimes call autonomous adaptation, and that's what people do in their day-to-day lives that they don't necessarily realize that they're doing it. And it's quite difficult to track in the same way that we track the things that are happening in the database, because that's based on things that are publicly available. They're online and we can collect them. So I guess there's sort of this idea that if the government is kind of leading the way and explaining things, people like me explaining what climate change adaptation is, then the other things will start to flow. But it's actually really, really difficult to understand the extent to which that behavior change is happening. But there is research that's starting to look at that. I was speaking to another researcher recently who's trying to write a paper about how is that autonomous adaptation happening, and where is adaptation invisible? Because that's also something that we've noticed, is there's a lot of adaptation that is actually invisible, and it's really, really hard to see what's going on.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. Tia, can you give us some examples from your database, some of your favorites? Like what are the things that like people would be surprised to hear are actually going on?
One of my favorite examples to talk about is urban trees and urban greening, because that's something that everybody has. Everybody has a tree on their street or in their backyard, and it's actually been such a big part of what local governments are investing in for climate change adaptation. I know in South Australia there's programs like Adopt a Street Tree program, where you make sure that your street tree has water through the extreme heat in summer, and so you just water that street tree. Or maybe you get a rebate on your land taxes because you have a tree on your property. And those trees are really important in extreme heat conditions, because in our urban environments the heat can be exacerbated by concrete and other surfaces that are reflecting heat. The trees provide shade, and the greening and the grass, it provides shade and cools the urban environment. So it's going to be increasingly important as we expect more extreme heat to go on. So that's one of my favorite examples to talk about.
I think I know, because it's interesting in some areas, like how like just not focused we are on maintaining trees and health. Like, I know the tree at the front of my house, and then where there's four on our sort of block, but it was dropping a lot of leaves on a couple of the neighbors' cars, and so they complained. The council came and chopped this thing down. It was like this 30-foot beautiful tree, and now I've got what I refer to affectionately as a stick. like, it's just, you know, I'm much taller than the replacement. I think this thing's going to take 20 years to. I think there was really no need, based on, you know, car preferences, to remove a beautiful tree that was healthy for one person's car. Yeah, and I think, you know, we need to focus more on what, you know, what's needed there. And I think there's certain suburbs, especially many of the newer outer suburb areas, where, you know, they kind of strip mine the land before they build them, and they remove all the existing sort of, you know, all the stuff Susie was just talking about before, you know, anything that's valuable to the soil and the land, and then all you have is these concrete jungles that, you know, and people are building and putting new trees in, but, you know, there's a decadal.
I was going to bring up that example of development where they do, well, historically they have often flattened everything that's in the land and then planted new trees, but those trees take 20 years to mature and to have those benefits
if they survive.
And so in the time that those trees are growing, then there's a really vulnerable community there who doesn't have much shade and exposed to heat. So there's a lot of work going on. I know South Australian state government has worked on this, where they're trying to encourage developers to leave the trees in the environment, or at least where they can, and then plant new trees on the street as well, so that the environment doesn't get so hot in that 20-year gap in between. It's going to be really important for that.
Very important if you have dogs.
100%.
We did that when we bought our house. Just like walk the dog around the block if it's not too hot in summer for his paws.
I don't go for walks after the sun's up in summer in Melbourne. It's crazy. Just hot. Well, Tia, look, this sounds like a great initiative and things that you're working on there with the database, and hopefully can people access it? Can people see the database?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's we've made it a publicly available website so that you can jump on and have a look and see what's happening in your local area. Cool. There is some local examples in in there, but we're expecting to add a lot more in this year. That's our focus for this year, is to add more local government examples. Yep. So you can just Google Australian Adaptation Database and it should come up right
Amazing.
Up for you.
Amazing. Tia Brewer, thank you so much for coming in and chatting to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, we're going to take a break for some station announcements, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about some cool new ideas around ovarian cancer.
There is plenty on offer this winter at Ceres Nursery in Brunswick East, including a fresh delivery of fruit trees, berries, seed potatoes and more, plus practical advice from qualified horticulturalists. Get to Ceres Nursery to begin a backyard harvest and plant native and indigenous species that support habitat creation and biodiversity in the garden. Triple R subscribers can access a 10% discount and every purchase supports Ceres Park. Ceres Nursery, Triple R sponsors.
Coming up at Kindred Bandroom, Crown Heights, The Scar Vendors, Pearly Shell's Hot Six, Jungle Jim Smith and GW3. Also in the calendar, free Thursday Arvo gigs with Catherine McQuaid, Sunshine Tip, Mark Ferry's Instant Noodles, Nick Charles, Shane O'Mara and Rebecca Barnard. For tickets and more info, head to kindredbandroom.com.au. Triple R sponsors. It's not a dirty word. Don't you believe
what you see? Some of Victoria's most critical habitat for native wildlife is on private land. Trust for Nature is a not-for-profit working with thousands of landholders through conservation covenants and land for wildlife to safeguard biodiversity and fight climate change. Donate by June 30 at trustfornature.org.au to help protect habitat forever. Trust for Nature, proud Triple R sponsors.
Lots of good Triple R sponsors there.
Nice.
I know. Good nature
sounds. Nature sounds are good.
Yeah. In the studio with us now, we have Dr. Gregor Ho, who is a clinician, scientist, and medical oncologist at Monash Health. Welcome to Triple R.
Thank you, Shane, for the opportunity to be here. It's a real privilege for me to be a voice for women living with ovarian cancer and their families.
Yeah, now you're doing some amazing work. So both as a researcher and as an oncologist, tell us a little bit about your story there. So did you start off as a clinician and then got interested in research, or was it the other way around? How did that work?
Research has always been my passion since I was in medical school. Realizing that to truly change how we manage cancer, we need to change how we improve, how we understand how cancer works, and to find ways to basically kill these things.
So when people come in with ovarian cancer, I mean, first of all, ovarian cancer is a whole different type of cancers, right? So it's not one cancer of the ovaries. It's the whole... Tell us a little bit about that. It's the whole region, isn't it, really?
It's a quite a diverse type of cancer. And I think what we realize over many years is we can't treat ovarian cancer as one disease. And lessons been learned from 20, 30 years of giving the same treatment just doesn't improve outcome. So we need to think of a more clever way to treat cancer.
Yep. And how does it compare, like when you talk about the treatments and what you see in the clinic, how does it compare to cancers like lung and breast cancer and blood cancers and, you know, all the other ones where we seem to be making some pretty substantial progress with immunotherapies and other therapies these days? How's ovarian cancer stacking up?
Yeah, it's unfortunately falling quite far behind. Right. We've seen immunotherapies making a lot of headways and really revolutionize how we treat lung cancer and skin cancer. For me, I truly believe that our immune system is possibly one of the most powerful tools we have to fight cancer. And we just need to get this into the ovarian cancer space.
Right. I remember a little while back hearing someone refer to it, I think, as the cancer cells in ovarian cancer were kind of dark, or they kind of, as in they knew how to hide from the immune system. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Correct, yeah. I often look at this as a gas and brake analogy, that our immune system need both, that to remove the roadblocks and obstacles to work, but also need a little bit of push as well.
Right.
Unfortunately, with ovarian cancer, pretty good in hiding themselves from our immune system.
Yeah.
So it's just a nasty thing.
Yeah,
it does seem very unpleasant. Not recommended. How good are we at detecting? Because my understanding is that ovarian cancer can be very aggressive. Mm-hmm. So getting in early is obviously preferable. But how good are we at actually detecting that it's a thing and what thing it is?
The cancer itself? Yeah. It's tricky. Mm-hmm. I've heard so many stories and experiences from patients and consumers, people going through the cancer. Some don't have any symptoms. Some just hit them, and by the time they found out, it's pretty late.
Wow.
So the statistic is...
Is that a major area of research, the detection rather than the treating?
Both. I think it's both. Okay. Detection is crucial. But where the cancer lies, it's in an area where it's prone to spread pretty early.
Right.
I guess even though we have really good methods to risk reduce the cancer, and women with high risk features, for those that carries the, for example, the BRCA genes, even though we remove the ovaries and the fallopian tubes, it still comes back or still develop disease.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, you know, most of the people I've encountered, and there's unfortunately a few who've had ovarian cancer, they've often said to me that, you know, they've presented at stage four, you know, like quite advanced by the time they actually, you know, get any sort of diagnosis. Now, you are working on a particular sort of sequence of drugs to try and deal with this issue of, well, especially where the cancer is really resistant to chemotherapies and other therapies. You're trying to find a new way to sort of get cut through that. So tell us about that. How are you going about that?
Correct. So so detection is one side of the story. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at the other spectrum where treatments fail and the cancers come back. And unfortunately for most women with ovarian cancer, it's limited number of lines of treatment that we can offer these women. So our research, funded by Ovarian Cancer Research Foundation, OCRF, there's two parts to it. So the first part was actually a study done at Mada Institute under Professor Brian Gabrielli and his postdoc, Jenny Zhang, where we're actually looking at ways to make the cancer a bit more visible to the cancer by targeting how the cancer tries to repair itself when it makes mistakes, and also to push the cancer through that. And our second funding from the Ovarian Cancer Research Foundation is actually try to then release that brakes as well. When each time when the cancer, we make changes to make the cancer more visible, it tries to initiate mechanism to hide itself more. So the second round of funding is actually to hit the brakes and the accelerator in both sides. So,
Look, that, I mean, it's so interesting when you hear about this this need to, you know, take what is such a successful type of therapy in other cancers and essentially soup it up so that it's going to work in something like ovarian cancer, because you want that same success. You know, you want, as you said, the immune system is the key here. And I've unfortunately been doing this show long enough to remember when people were first talking about immunotherapy, and it was almost a joke. It was like, hang on, so when someone's sickest, you want to rely on their immune system? Like, and people back then were like, ah, that doesn't make any sense. But you know, now it's the ticket. You know, it's one of the great hopes of therapy. So, how far along are you? Like, when do you think? Are you actually starting to use these techniques in the clinic, or is it still in the experimental stages?
So the first round is we're working closely with Australian New Zealand Gynecology Oncology Group or ANSCOG. So we are trying to get the first round of clinical trial through them, and with the second funding from OCRF coming through, so the first round treatment will be trials beyond double therapy, the two oral treatment that mentioned in our paper recently, and the next round of we know that eventually is good, but it might not be as good. Then the next round of funding from OCRF to see how we can incorporate a triple therapy, so immune checkpoint inhibitor into this to make it, to seal it.
Yep. Well, it's impressive work, and I have to say, you know, hats off to the Ovarian Cancer Research Foundation for funding this. You know, I hope you're getting government funding as well, but, you know, it's great to see these foundations stepping up and doing such amazing work. I don't envy you the work you do. It must be incredibly challenging dealing with this and having to work with families and all the various people who are ending up with ovarian cancer, especially those who have, you know, less than ideal outcomes. Thanks so much for chatting to us today on Triple R.
Amazing. And just one thing, I think it's, we need to be quicker, accelerate this more. Every day I see patient in, like I mentioned, the patient in the chat about Jamie, you and the family just need to get this treatment through as soon as possible.
Money buys your speed. So hopefully more funding will come with. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Shane.
Folks, we're going to take a short break for some station announcements, and we'll be back talking about astrophysics. What a segue. There we go.
Have you checked out Triple R's on-demand service via the new app? It's a chance to catch up on our programming that's normally for the night owls. Try checking out Long Distance with Monica Vidogirite, a sonic bridge between past and present, here and there. And Opium Audio with Shambe Olwenipu, exploring thematic and contextual ties of the underground with a hauntological mix of 80s, 90s house, R&B, electronic, jungle, post-punk, grunge rock, bossa nova, samba, jazz and ambient avant pop. You can listen to Triple R anytime on demand via the Triple R app.
The Castlemaine Documentary Festival is on June 26 to 28, and it's worth the drive from Melbourne. 3 days of bold, true stories at the Theatre Royal, with Coexistence My Ass, fresh from its Sundance Award, plus local premieres and filmmakers in the room. Catch Move Your Body, The Birth of House on the Saturday, then dance it out at the after party with DJ Jen Moore. Tickets at c.ff.com.au. Triple R sponsors.
Primary Succession, a new immersive exhibition by Wanna Bay and Charlie Lawler. Shaped by climate change, shifting landscapes and nocturnal rhythms. Here, ecosystems adapt, memory lives in the landscape, and humans are no longer at the centre of the story. Primary Succession, now showing in Dandenong. Learn more at Walker Street Gallery. Presented by Greater Dandenong City Council. Proud Triple R sponsor.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Einstein A Go-Go. I'm Dr. Shane, and in the studio with us now we have Dr. Rebecca Davies. Now, Rebecca is an ARC DECRA Fellow and Senior Lecturer in the Centre for Astrophysics and Supercomputing at Swinburne University. Rebecca, welcome back to Triple R.
Thank you for having me again.
It's great to have you back. I mean, whenever someone says to me, I want to talk about astronomy, I'm like, yep, come on.
it's like the only thing that gets you on the show immediately.
It's a very easy sell, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Oh, come on. It's the best stuff.
They're hitting your buttons, Shane.
Yeah. I'm a failed astronomer. It's my thing. One of the coolest things, of course, is that your work involves the James Webb Space Telescope. How do you get time on that? Do you just sort of put your hand up and say, can I have an hour here and there? Or can you point it in this direction? Tell us how that works.
Yeah, I think we all wish it was that easy to get time on the James Webb Telescope.
If that's what it is, tell me how to do it.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, the James Webb, of course, is very much in demand because it's the biggest, the best, the latest telescope that allows us to see further back in the universe than we've ever seen before. So essentially, once per year, NASA puts out a call for proposals. If you want some time, you need to write a detailed application saying exactly what scientific question you want to answer and how much time you need to do that. And then all of those applications are submitted and peer-reviewed by a panel of astronomers that are experts in your topic, and then all the proposals get ranked, and typically only about 10% of those applications will be successful because everyone wants to use the James Webb Telescope.
There you go.
See, I told you, Chris, our chances are low.
Oh, yeah, but so that's an interesting question, though. So of the 10% they get through, do they get through because they're credible and reliable, or because they're out there and interesting?
I think there's really a combination. So, I mean,
because I can do out there.
Yeah. they've got to be out there and credible, I think, is the key.
Okay. Damn it.
You've got issues there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, of course, with any new telescope like James Webb, one of the big exciting things that we can do is discover things that we've never found before. Mm. So people really do want to, follow clues or things that they think might be interesting. But then it's also important to do the more detailed studies that we can really start to disentangle the detailed physics of things in the universe. So I think there's some kind of combination. But really, a lot of these proposals are really good, and it's just at some point up to luck of who reviews the proposals and whether they like your project. But also something interesting is that all of the observations taken by James Webb end up on an archive that's maintained by NASA. It's an online database, essentially, and the data is typically proprietary for something like 12 months, but after that, it's accessible to anyone from the general public, so you can go and download data from James Webb and play with it, and often it's reduced to some level, so you can sort of just look at it with your eyes.
People like me. Yeah, thanks.
It's so cool. And we will get on to your work, I promise, Rebecca, just after we get 27 questions about the James Webb out of the way. And when they're scheduling things, like, I can imagine they want to minimize fuel usage. So, you know, if Chris and I both have a target relatively close to one another, presumably it would be scheduled so that they would be done in sequence. So, I mean, how does that work for you? You're in the Southern Hemisphere. So, you know, is there any sort of negativity associated with that because most of the applications come from the Northern Hemisphere and people interested in the Northern Hemisphere skies? Is that a thing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So, yeah, typically the scheduling is quite complicated. Mm. It's done by algorithms. There's a few things that they have to take into account. Fuel usage is one of them, but also, obviously, the James Webb telescope is in the infrared, so it has to stay cold, and it has this whopping great sun shield to stop it from being hit by light from the sun. But obviously, you know, it can't look towards the sun, so that's another big constraint. And also, another problem is micrometeorite hits. So as the telescope is traveling through space, there's always the chance that the mirror will get hit by some space rocks.
Yep.
So generally, they try not to look too close to the direction that the telescope is moving.
Yeah.
So there's a few different constraints. And actually, when you're submitting your application, part of it is that you have to run this sort of scheduling thing to see whether what you're requesting is actually viable to be scheduled. If you give it too many constraints, they might just not be able to do it. But in answer to the Southern Hemisphere thing, actually, a lot of people do want to observe things in the Southern Hemisphere because a lot of the world's biggest ground-based telescopes are in the Southern Hemisphere, in the Atacama Desert in Chile. So there's also a lot of telescopes in the Northern Hemisphere, but I think it's quite balanced out in that regard.
We're just better.
There is that.
Of course,
We're just better. I think that's so cool. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but I remember when I first heard about the telescope being located at a Lagrange point, so a sort of an eddy, if you will, where gravitational forces from various objects equal out, so it's a stable point. And I thought, actually, that's a bad idea because there'd be a lot of crap there. But then I learned that it actually orbits around that point. So it's not actually at a Lagrange point, it actually orbits around it. So all the crap that probably accumulated at the Lagrange point over history, bits of rock and so forth. It actually is not there. It orbits it. Is that right?
Yeah, so the James Webb is orbiting the Lagrange point, and there's also the other telescopes also at the same point, so they can all orbit around it and not interfere with each other
very
too
carefully.
Much.
I mean.
It's just like heavy traffic.
But that would be quite an exercise in fine tuning because every time, when you're in orbit, but there's going to be competing and changing gravitational pulls every time you veer even slightly, turn even slightly.
Smart people at NASA.
And the fact that this is so far away from us.
Yeah, well, thankfully.
I mean, it is rocket science, kind of.
It is, really.
Right. I promised we would talk about the rest of the game.
So you
have been using the James Webb Telescope to look at a particular type of galaxy that's far, far away.
Of course.
And it's weird. So tell us, what is going on with this galaxy? How far away is it, and why is it of interest?
Yeah, so the particular galaxy that we've been looking at is a galaxy that we see as it was 1 billion years after the Big Bang.
Okay.
So one of the cool things about astronomy is that the further away we look, the further back in time we're seeing, because the light from those galaxies takes billions and billions of years to reach us.
Yep.
In this case, about, you know, almost 13 billion years, because now the universe we think is something like 13.8 billion years old. So this particular galaxy we found is interesting because it seems to have what we term a galaxy-killing wind. Okay. Very technical term.
That's cool.
that's one of the reasons I love astronomy, because we don't give names to things that people can't pronounce. Right. It's a very large telescope.
We're not very creative with our names.
Great names. Everyone can understand
it. Good. That's working class drama, that is. Galaxy killing wind.
I feel like that's what I call the next blast, in Arctic blast in Melbourne next time. It's galaxy killing wind today.
Okay, so we've got a galaxy killing wind. Yes. So hang on. Wind in space. You've got to explain this.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah. So, you know, people think that space is empty, which is more or less true. So this is a wind that's being launched from the center of a galaxy. So in this case, what we have is a galaxy that's colliding with another galaxy. Mm-hmm. These collisions are funneling lots of gas to the center of galaxies.
Okay.
And gas is what galaxies use to form stars.
Okay.
So lots of gas, lots of stars forming. Then when the stars get to the end of their lives, they explode as supernovae.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this energy being pushed outwards from the galaxy essentially drives this big wind. It's I think of it like a cosmic geyser, essentially,
right.
Or like, you know, a volcano eruption in space, something like that. And so these winds, we think, are very important for the evolution of galaxies because they're throwing out all this material that would otherwise be used to form new stars.
Yep.
Like a shockwave.
And so essentially the galaxy's ongoing life is truncated then. Is that right? Like it kind of stops it continuing.
Yeah. Well, the long-term impact on the galaxy really depends on what happens to the material once it's been thrown out. So that depends a bit on how fast the material is moving as well. So the more energy that is imparted into the gas, the faster it can go. And if it's, you know, traveling way, way faster than the escape velocity, which is how much velocity it needs to escape from the gravitational pull of the galaxy, then it will go off into interstellar space. And we actually think that these galaxy winds play an important role in seeding the elements of life across the universe.
Right.
Because, you know, after the Big Bang, there was only hydrogen and helium, and all of the heavier elements are formed through nuclear fusion reactions in stars.
Mm.
So things like carbon and oxygen are formed in stars, and then when stars explode and that material is pushed out of galaxies, we're sending all of these heavy elements across the universe.
Yeah, that's so cool. When you look around at various galaxies, because I know this was a fairly early galaxy in the universe, when you look around, do you see differences in the types of stars in each galaxy depending on these wind levels? So, like, if the winds are really strong, or, you know, there's a lot of that, presumably there's a lower degree of new star formation after a period, and so all the stars would appear old. Like, do you see that in other galaxies, all these galaxies?
Yeah, so models do predict that in galaxies with strong winds, they will stop forming stars.
Yep.
And so we can tell basically how long ago a galaxy last formed stars by looking at the ages of the stars that are currently present. Because, you know, when a galaxy forms a whole bunch of stars, it forms some lower mass stars that tend to be cooler, and these stars live for a really long time. Our sun is relatively cool on the scale of stars, and it's going to live for, you know, at least 10 billion years.
Yep.
And then the galaxy also forms much more massive stars that sort of burn out all their fuel really quickly. We say they live fast and die young.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So they
good rock stars.
they might only be alive for a million years or something. Yep. So that's like 1,000 times or even 10,000 times less than the higher mass stars. So when we look at these galaxies and we see that they only have those longer living stars and not the massive shorter lived stars, then we know that they haven't formed any stars recently.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, some of the light that we're talking about here that you're collecting has been traveling for billions of years.
Yeah.
So these little photons have been travelling for billions of years and eventually you stop. Do you feel any guilt?
That's the way to go. Yeah.
They were on their big cosmic journey. Well, you know, we only collect a very tiny fraction of all of the photons from these galaxies. Because you can imagine, like, you know, you have a galaxy in the very early universe. It's sending out light in all directions. If you can imagine, you know, the Earth as like a tiny little speck in this sphere where the photons are propagating out, that's why we need such big telescopes to be able to detect these things, because, you know, the light has been spread out over such a large surface. Mm. So in order to collect enough of them that we can actually detect anything, we need this really big mirror. So there's a lot more of those photons that are continuing on their journeys through the universe.
No guilt. That's
very good. I think that's, on the contrary, I think these particles have chosen us. I think that's we're fulfilling their potential. Do you use radio astronomy data as well, radio astronomy technology as well? Because it seems like that's made for the kinds of time and space scales you're talking about.
Yeah, so in this study, we also use data from the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, which is an array of radio telescopes in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And that was actually really important because the James Webb showed us this wind that's being ejected from the galaxy, but with the radio telescope, we can actually study the cooler gas that is the fuel for the galaxies to form stars. So these radio telescopes are really important because basically they can tell us like the reservoir of material that's left. And in this particular case, what we saw was sort of a plume of this star-forming fuel being entrained out of the galaxy by this wind, which is something that gives us a clue that it's going to have a significant impact on the future life and star formation in this system.
Such cool stuff. One of the things I wanted to ask you, given the sort of location of these galaxies being so far away, is there sort of gravitational lensing involved between us and that galaxy? And to clarify that for people, you know, sometimes these things are so far away and so dim, the only way we can see them is that there's something massive between us and these objects that acts like a magnifying lens that gives more light to our telescopes. Is there something like that between us and these far distant objects that is required, or are we just lucky in this case that you can see them directly?
Yeah, so in this particular case, there's no gravitational lensing involved. This particular galaxy is one of the most massive galaxies in the early universe. Right. At the moment, it's actually forming stars really quickly. So this particular galaxy has not yet died. Right. But because it's forming so many stars and having this wind that's blasting away the gas so quickly, we think that we might have caught it just at the peak before it goes towards a sudden death.
So that's exciting.
Yeah.
Like, watch that now.
So
over the next million years.
yeah. If you're really patient.
I'm not.
one of the first things that the James Webb found when it turned on was that there were a lot more big dead galaxies in the early universe than our models predicted. And if you look at sort of the history of how these galaxies form stars, they did seem to do this kind of live fast, die young thing where they had a peak where they had a really high rate of new star formation and then suddenly seemed to decline. And so one of the reasons that our new result is so interesting is because it could give us sort of a model for why galaxies might go through this evolutionary path, essentially.
Yeah. I just think, one of the things I absolutely love about astronomy, and you know, we're almost out of time, but, you know, people often talk about ice cores, you know, and how the further down you dig, you know, the further back in time you go. And it's exactly the same as astronomy. You know, the further you look, the further back in time you go, which means you can look at a galaxy that age, and then you can look at comparative galaxies all the way through the time sequence up until now. And so you get to see the whole life. I mean, it's not the one galaxy you're looking at different times, but you can see similar ones at various stages of development, right?
Yeah, that's precisely it. So while we can't look at what's going to happen to an individual galaxy, we can't trace the lifetime of any particular system because these changes take billions of years, but instead we can study populations of galaxies at different times in the universe. So, you know, 1 billion years after the Big Bang, 2 billion, 3 billion, all the way up to, you know, 13.8 billion years. And then by doing that, we can link how galaxies grow and change over time, which is very cool.
Super cool. Dr. Rebecca Davies, we have a number of new telescopes launching, hopefully later in the year as well. There's all sorts of things happening. We will need our basic explanation of all those again at some stage. So if you're happy to come back and guide us through that, that would be amazing. But thanks so much for coming in today. It is really fascinating stuff and great work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Folks, that was Dr. Rebecca Davies from Swinburne University of Technology. You guys, okay? I know I geek out a bit about the astro stuff. You okay?
I'm just glad that we've established a numbers game before we had this, because yeah. We now know what a billion really looks like. You know? Yeah.
It's a lot.
It is a lot.
And how to use it.
This is like you throw these numbers out, you know, like yeah. Elon Musk is worth, whatever, $1 billion.
No, he's
like,
not.
I don't know
like
what
a trillion.
That
means. It's the next
I'm pretty sure he's not
like,
worth it.
He's not worth it. He's worth a $5.
The output is really not, but you know, you see these numbers right, and you're like, I have no concept of what this is. So
yeah.
Glad
yeah.
we did that.
Yeah, there you go.
Pat on the shoulder for me.
Unfortunately, the concept that we have to get our head around is 60 minutes, and now 60 is almost up. So yeah. We are going to hand over in a moment to the team from EDIT. Thank you both for coming in. Good
pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Folks, thanks so much for listening to Einstein the Go-Go. I'm Dr. Shane. Remember, science is everywhere. Have a wonderful Sunday, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Why don't we eat?
Dear, don't cause a fuss. I'll have your spam. I love it. I'm having spam, spam, spam.
Cornflakes! 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 Cornflakes!
You man fancy a pint?
Suit you, sir.
Spam, 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 baked beans, spam, 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 and spam!
I said I don't want any damn vegetables.
Lentils are really good, you know?
Forbidden donut.